Welcome to the Bulwark Podcast. I'm Charlie Sykes. We are recording this on Friday morning, where we just got these rather remarkable jobs numbers suggesting that the economy actually added 2.5 million jobs. The unemployment rate has dropped down to 13.3%. So it's morning in America again, right? Bottom line, though, and I think it's kind of an instant classic, the economists missed their estimates by more than 10 million jobs. So I was going to say that these numbers would suggest that I don't know anything about the state of the economy, but maybe nobody knows anything about the state of the economy. So we are joined today by Bakari Sellers, who is now, we talked about how I was going to introduce you. You're an American attorney, political commentator. You've been a politician. You're an author. You have a new book out, My Vanishing Country. You've grown a beard during the pandemic. All of these. Have I missed any of the high points?
Well, you know, husband and father, are the most amazing things. But this beard, I was on yesterday with Wolf, and Wolf was literally jealous of my beard. So I think I'm making progress.
Well, I tried to do a beard, and I've mentioned this before. The problem is I wake up at 2 a.m. and it's just so itchy. I got up and I shaved it off. So and basically, it was a pretty scraggly beard anyway. I have no pride in the beard whatsoever. You are rocking the beard. This is a significant beard thing you got going.
This was a commitment, and I am proud of the discipline that it took to get me this far. I think I'm going to shave one day soon. I think that's breaking news, Charlie. So I'm probably going to let it go next week. So I want people to get their last little looks at a young Marvin Gaye or Teddy Pendergrass in their prime, because that's what I'm going for with this.
That is what you are going for. Okay, so just a little bit of background for folks. You were elected to the state legislature in South Carolina when you were 22 years old, which made you the youngest African-American elected official in the country. You gave up that seat to run for lieutenant governor as a Democrat in South Carolina, which would indicate there's a little bit of Don Quixote in you running as a Democrat.
That actually was the definition of insanity. You know, I tell people when I ran for lieutenant governor, I was young, I was Black, I was a Democrat, and I was a young Black Democrat. And so, you know, you had those strikes against you. But, you know, the winner of that race is now governor. Henry McMaster is our governor. I gave him my all. I actually got 41-42% of the vote. And so I say that I chipped away at the glass for people like Andrew Gillum and people like Stacey Abrams, who came after, and maybe even a Jamie Harrison this year or a Ralph Warnock in Georgia. So we ran a good race back in 2014, but came up short.
Well, and also South Carolina is interesting politics, and I'm not claiming that I'm an expert, but you know, given as a Wisconsinite, we think of South Carolina as very, very deep South, and of course you had you have a Black United States Senator, right?
Correct.
You had Nikki Haley, who was the governor of the state. It was one of the first states that actually lowered the Confederate flag. So, and then of course you're also represented by Lindsey Graham, which, you know, go figure, in the United States Senate. So,
where exactly were you going with the Lindsey Graham? So
I'm just trying to figure it out. Yeah. I mean, it's just, you look at, okay, here you have Tim Scott, you have Lindsey Graham, you have Nikki Haley. It's weird.
It's weird. So, and you know, one of the things I talk about in My Vanishing Country is during my service in the General Assembly, I sat next, my desk was next to Nikki Haley. The president of my freshman class was Mick Mulvaney. Tim Scott, I used to make him go buy us lunch because he was a rookie. I got elected in 06. Tim didn't get elected till 2010. And so, you know, we hazed and razzed Tim Scott. Mark Sanford was my governor at the time. And you remember Mark, everybody remembers Mark, a true conservative.
Yeah. He's been on this podcast.
Yeah. I love Mark is actually a good friend of mine. And so you serve with all of these varying personalities and individuals. Jeff Duncan, who has made himself relatively indiscreet member of Congress. He was chairman of Ag, but South Carolina, we're punching above our weight. I mean, for Nikki, for Mick, myself, even Andre Bauer, who was a former lieutenant governor who spent some time at CNN, we punch above our weight. And yes, it is a level of insanity in South Carolina politics. But we say, I mean, to go back to the days of John McCain having a Black baby, do you remember those attacks?
Oh, yeah.
And Lee Atwater, if you can make it through South Carolina politics, you can make it through about anything. So I think people are really arriving on the national scene.
So is it that South Carolina politics is bare knuckle hardball, or is it also part of a culture where you actually had to talk to one another and work with one another?
It's both. Yeah. South Carolina politics is brutal, in that it's literally no holds barred. You know, I have rules in my politics. Like these rules may sound a little bit awkward, but I never ever talk about someone's spouse. And I never talk about where people send their kids to school. I think that's a very personal choice. And people are going to be like, where they send their kids to school? Why is that ever an attack? In South Carolina, school choice is one of the biggest issues we have. And that's just a line that I won't cross. I think people can make those personal choices. But yeah, it's a bare knuckle brawl. And the reason I brought it up in my book is that we had to. You have to be willing to talk across the aisle. It's a friendly environment outside of the campaign season, and so I consider Nikki Haley a friend. I consider Tim Scott and Trey Gowdy are friends. I talk to them in a group chat as often as we can. It's meeting people where they are. It's a politics from a day that's passed us by.
So your book, and I'm looking at the review. You've gotten very good reviews for this. The Kirkus review is extremely positive. You know, your Vanishing Country has been compared to J.D. Vance's Hillbilly Elegy from the point of view of what it's like to grow up in an African American in the rural South. And what's very clear from this book is that, you know, you go way, way, way back. You're what, only 34 years old, but you've been doing this
for 35 now.
Yeah, 35. Okay, yeah. We're over the hill. But I mean, your father was very, very involved in the civil rights movement. You knew a lot of the players in the civil rights movement. This is something that you grew up with. This at your dinner table, and I want to talk about that just for a moment. But let's just start for, you know, the moment we are in right now. I want to get your take on this, whether you think, you know, of this moment where we continue to have these protests all across the country about police violence. Give me your just sense of, you know, are we at a tipping point where things will change, or is this just a replay of the loop that we've been in since the 1960s?
So this is 1918. Meets 1968. And that's how I describe it. The reason being is because we cannot forget that this pandemic is ravaging our communities. And then we have 1968, and people are like, why 1968? One of my heroes in media, we need more of him, is Tom Brokaw, right? And Tom Brokaw did the book and the documentary, Boom, 1968. And why did he say it was boom? Because you had February 8th, 1968, and we'll get into that. That's when my father was shot, and three young men, Henry Smith, Samuel Hammond, and Delano Middleton, were killed, and 28 others were injured on the campus of South Carolina State University while they were protesting the All-Star Bowling Alley in Little Lawrenceburg, South Carolina. Then you had April 4th of 68. That was the assassination of King. And then you had June of that year. You had the assassination of RFK. And you had all your soldiers coming home from Vietnam. And so it was a tinderbox. It was on, the country was on fire. And I think you have a combination of both of those things, a pandemic and the country becoming untethered over the issue of race. I am not as confident or as hopeful as some others are, to your point, Charlie, because Black folk in this country live in a perpetual sense of grief. And we've been at this moment before, and the way the moment usually works is that there is a death followed by a harsh reality either met by the situation or in the setting, i.e. Mother Emanuel Lammy Church, or the fact you can see it, a video or a picture, i.e. Emmett Till or the Edmund Pettus Bridge or Ahmaud Arbery or in this case, George Floyd. And then you go through pain, and you go through the streets, and you go through the agony, and you go through the uprising, you go through the rebellion, and then you go through the grief and the memorial where we are now. And then this just happens all over again. So like, when, at what point are we going to break the cycle? I mean, Roy Wilkins once asked a great question. The famed civil rights leader asked a great question. He said, how many coffins are we going to have to walk behind before we get the change we're looking for? And that's my point. How many coffins are we going to have to walk behind? And there is an amazing image of George Floyd's little 6-year-old daughter standing on sitting on the shoulders of Steven Jackson, the NBA player. And she's saying, my daddy changed the world. I mean, how many more of those little girls are we going to have who won't be able to cook their father Father's Day breakfast? I mean, that's the question that's before us. And that's the question we have to answer.
What do you think the answer is, though? What in fact, will it take? You know, part of me thinks that we're being confronted by these images in a way that we have not been before, and therefore that they are assaulting our conscience in a different way. But the other part of me is, you know, has been through this before, has seen it before, and watching also how we have become, you know, more and more, you know, separated into various silos, so that you have half of America looking at the images of George Floyd, the other half of the country are looking at images of rioters, you know, burning down churches and things like that. So that if you want to have your conscience flayed, you can. If you want to have your prejudices reconfirmed, you can do that too.
You can, and that's, I mean, that's the disservice of some cable news right now. I mean, let's just call BS what it is. But I want to go back just briefly, because I want people to understand when they listen to the two most brilliant minds in you know, entertainment right now, Bakari Sellers and Charlie Sykes, they grasp why we believe there's an awakening. This was so inhumane. Like, Charlie, do you know another human being that can put their knee on a human being's neck for 8.5 minutes?
No, literally, no.
I mean, none. You don't. I mean, people don't treat dogs like that. And, you know, I got corrected because I was on last week and saying that, you know, they treated him like a dog. And somebody said, well, Bakari, if he was a dog, they would have made the arrest sooner, which does have some validity. but, you know, that is just in the consciousness of the country. It was been awakening. In that, you know, minute 2 and 3 and 4, because people, I mean, this man was calling out for his dead mother. He was unconscious for 3 minutes and the knee stayed there. So people are looking at this like, so when black folk tell me they were pulled over and it didn't necessarily go the way it goes for me and you, I can see if this happened to George Floyd, I can see how it might happen now. And so people are beginning to recognize and realize what's going on in our communities. And that I think is the first step. And we can't miss this moment because we've missed it before. I've been a part of this before. I mean, and we laugh and I laugh at how old I am, but you know, in My Vanishing Country, I highlight not only the Orangeburg Massacre, but I talk about the Charleston Massacre, which people remember. And, you know, I had a friend and 8 others who were killed because of the color of their skin in Bible study in a church. And we missed that moment. We didn't create any changes that are systemic. And I mean, we didn't even change our gun laws after Dylann Roof illegally purchased a weapon. So, well, legally, I mean, he waited the 48 hours, but should not have been able to get that weapon. And so I just don't want to miss this moment again, but there's nothing in me that says our history states that we need that moment.
Well, let's talk about this history, because you were saying you joke about how old you are. I'll tell you about, you know, how old I am, and this is what really, you know, struck me in your book, because I remember 1968 vividly. I've forgotten whole decades, but I remember everything that I was doing in 1968. I was a kid. This was the most exciting year of my life. I remember exactly where I was when Martin Luther King Jr. was assassinated. I remember exactly where I was when Bobby Kennedy was assassinated. I was in Chicago for the Mayor Daley police riots in the summer of 1968. So I remember every detail of 1968. And then I'm reading in your book about the Orangeburg Massacre, and I'm thinking,
never heard of it.
I probably heard of it, but I don't remember it. So I and this seems to be a seminal moment this was a seminal moment in your life, even though it was obviously before you were born. Tell me about the Orangeburg Massacre and how it changed your life.
I mean, I mentioned just the cliff notes earlier, but my father got involved in the movement. His consciousness was awakened at 10 years old, because in 1955, he refers to Mamie Till as the strongest woman in the movement. And the reason that he says she was so strong is because she had an open casket for Emmett. You know, she allowed the world to see what racism and bigotry had done to her son. You know, for those who are listening, who have not seen the pictures of Emmett Till, go Google it. It shocks your conscience. He literally had no bones left intact in his face. He was beaten for allegedly whistling at a white woman, Carolyn Bryant. That's who Amy Cooper reminds me of, by the way, the woman who wanted to call the police on the birder. She reminds me of Carolyn Bryant. Mm-hmm. And Carolyn Bryant, trying to get into heaven just a few years ago, finally admitted that she was never whistled at. But they beat him and they tied him up and they threw him in the bottom of the Mississippi. And my father began to go out in his little community in Denmark, South Carolina, where I'm from, where we have 3 stoplights and a blinking light. And he began to lead marches and protests and sit-ins since the age of 14. And my parents, my grandparents, were middle class. And they were not only afraid for his safety, but they were afraid for their own economic security. So they packed him up and they sent him to Howard University. And I chuckle when I say Howard University, because most black folk are going to be like, when you're trying to get somebody out the movement, you don't send them to Howard University. That's like the height of irony. Mm-hmm. And so when he got to Howard, he befriended a man named Stokely Carmichael, who graduated from Howard. My father dropped out of school. He dropped out of school and joined SNCC. His first mission was to go to Philadelphia, Mississippi, to look for the bodies of Goodman, Schroener, and Cheney. He led the search missions. And then he came back to Orangeburg. In Orangeburg, they were protesting what the history books call the last vestige of discrimination. It was a small whites-only bowling alley. They went back to their campus on the night of the 8th. They built a huge bonfire. South Carolina state troopers lined up along the embankment in front of their campus, and for 8 seconds, they fired shots into the group of students. Henry, Samuel, and Delano were murdered, and 28 others, along with my father, were injured. My father went to the hospital. He was pointed out by the only black sheriff's deputy in Orangeburg County, and he was arrested. He was arrested and charged with 5 felony counts. His bond was denied, so he was housed on death row. In between the time of his trial and February 8th of 68, all eight, nine officers who fired were tried. They were all found not guilty. My father was charged, tried, and convicted of rioting, becoming the first and only one-man riot in the history of this country. His indictment was backdated from February 8th to February 6th, and he ended up going to prison for a year.
How old was he then?
Let's see. My father, in February of 68, was 23. Mm-hmm. When he began to serve his prison sentence, he was in 73. He was 20. How old was that? He was born in 44, so he was 28. Yeah, 28. Mm-hmm. So he was young, and he ended up serving a year of hard labor. And the reason it's so important to me, and it's important to me for two. One is the 50,000 foot view, that people know about Kent State, and to a lesser extent, people know about Jackson State, but people don't know about.
No, this is exactly my point. And it really struck me that this had happened, and it happened during a year in which so many other things happened, but still quite dramatic. So I'm just going back. So this was years before you were born, but your father then was a convicted felon.
Correct. And that was the personal part of this. Like not only was he a convicted felon, but my sister was born while my father was in prison. Like my mom had to bear a child, give birth to a child by herself. There's this cool picture of my dad and mom on the prison yard. And they take one of those photos. You remember the photos? Of course you did, Charlie, but those photos that you had to like shake to clear up.
Yeah, sure.
With a Polaroid. Yeah.
Polaroid, absolutely.
They had another inmate take a Polaroid picture, and they both have these huge afros, and my dad is holding my sister, giving her a bottle. And that was the first time that he'd ever seen his child. And just that trauma and that pain continuously and living with that felony. Governor McNair was the governor in 68, if you want to be wonky on South Carolina politics. He was the front runner at the time to be the vice presidential nominee in 1968. After the unrest in Orangeburg, his stock plummeted. And there were many people, even reporters who were with him at the convention, he was still holding out hope because he had arrested the outside agitator, who was my dad, who caused all of these issues. It wasn't law enforcement or uprising. It was one person. It was that man from SNCC who did it. He never got that call. He was so disappointed. They prosecuted my father to the fullest extent, and he was pardoned, of course, in South Carolina lure by a Republican governor.
Who is that?
Carroll Campbell, one of the greatest governors in the history of South Carolina.
So the officers, you said, were tried and then acquitted. So someone who charged them?
This was the first time in the history of the United States of America that law enforcement faced federal charges for shooting and killing a black person.
So it was the feds that came in. Sure. So you, as you, when you grew up, though, your father stayed very involved in the, you know, in the civil rights movement, very, very close to the folks from SNCC, which was at that time considered more radical than Martin Luther King Jr. You correct me if I'm wrong in any of this.
You're correct.
Stokely Carmichael was, he was a polarizing figure. I mean, he intended to be. So you grew up knowing these people. You talk about, you know, if you pick up the phone, it might be Mrs. Cleaver. It might be Stokely Carmichael. This was the world you were born into.
This is the world I was born into. Like I'm a product of the proverb, it takes a village to raise a child. And so my network was Uncle Stokely. Uncle Marion was Marion Barry. I don't let anybody talk bad about Marion around me, Charlie. Like Marion was one of the greatest American mayors of all time. Now, personally, he had some flaws, but he was a fabulous mayor for the city of Washington, D.C. Kathleen Cleaver, Jesse Jackson, all of these people. My father was the Southeast Regional Field Director for Jesse in 84 and 88, working with people like Donna Brazile. These are the people I grew up with and the people that I hold in high esteem.
So when you were elected at 22 to the state legislature, you were already an old soul. You'd been around this for decades already.
I was an old soul. My father actually ran for office before, and I laugh because he never won. So I always tell him I was the only one to ever win anything in our house. But I was an old soul. And, I still look at the lens of everything socially, politically, and culturally through the lens of the civil rights movement. I'm a child of the movement.
But you don't come off as a Stokely Carmichael acolyte. So tell me about your evolution. It's unlikely that you would have had the career that you had you gone in that direction. Have you describe who you are now compared to that?
So let's talk through that. Like I remind people all the time, like the president's Gallup approval rating today, I'm assuming I haven't seen it, so hope people don't throw things at me, but it's probably between 40 and 48. That's usually where it hovers, right?
Right.
Okay. Martin Luther King Jr. at his last Gallup approval rating was in 1964 or 66. I think it was 64 before he died. He was at 32%. So let's always put into perspective that the love that Martin Luther King has today is a lot because of the whitewashing. It wasn't a real love then. You know, he was hated. He was a revolutionary. He was in Memphis, Tennessee, protesting because of the conditions of sanitation workers. I mean, let's truly remember who Dr. King was. Mm-hmm. But the question in my politics, I tell people my politics, I much rather be considered a Julian Bond than a Barack Obama. And that's no slight against 44. I love 44. But I just find myself to be a child of the movement who understands that struggle and who wants to deconstruct systems of oppression from within. Now, Stokely, on the other hand, you're right. Stokely was someone who put pressure on systems from the outside. Stokely was someone who yelled, was yelling black power in Greenwood, Mississippi. Black power not necessarily meaning to wreak fear in the hearts of white people throughout the country, but black power meaning that black folk needed to attain political power and economic power so they could be self-sustaining and rebuild their own communities. And so, I think that there are elements of the movement that I take, but our movement is changing and adapting, although we still have a lot of blood in the streets.
So you use the term social justice a lot.
Correct.
So what does that actually look like? What does social justice look like?
So social justice looks like, and you break it down in the buckets, right? So social justice looks like the fact that we shouldn't have poor people and brown people in this country who don't have access to clean water, whether or not that's Flint, Michigan, or where I'm from in Denmark, South Carolina, where we don't have potable water. Social justice looks like educational justice, because as you know, in this country, you're punished because of the zip code you're born into. Mm-hmm. It looks like access to quality care. Now, I'm not here having a conversation about Medicare for all and all these other things, because where I'm from, we don't even have a hospital. So if you get sick, you die. I mean, I'm talking about just access to care. Social justice looks like not having to live in a food desert. You know, people take this for granted. But a food desert is when you can't go 2 and 3 miles and get healthy, fresh fruits and vegetables as an alternative. And that's where, you know, Denmark is. That's where I grew up. And so social justice not only looks like criminal justice and the way we reform policing, but social justice encompasses educational justice, environmental justice, just necessity and yeah. You're talking about food insecurity, access to quality care. And Charlie, let me talk about the healthcare system real quick, not sure. To really go off on a tangent, but to tie it back into social justice. I've had three in my 35 years of great wisdom. I took a year. I don't know if I'm gonna count 2020 as a true year on my age. I might be 35 again, just because 2020 shouldn't count. But
I'm with you on that.
In the last year, I've had some unique experiences with our healthcare system. In 2010, of course, we lost our hospital. And me and Nikki Haley, my buddy, we still, politically, I'm still pissed off at her. Because if she would have expanded Medicaid, I would have been able to regain my hospital. And rural hospitals throughout South Carolina would not be shutting down as they are. But she made a political decision over the decision of the lives of South Carolinians. But I digress. So you lost your hospital. That's one. Last year, January 7th at 5:28, Stokely was born, and at 5:33, Sadie was born. And by 11 o'clock, my wife was passed out. She had thrown up. It was just me, my wife, and a lactation specialist. She began to shake. She kept complaining about being hot. We pulled the covers back, and there was blood everywhere. She lost 7 units of blood. She hemorrhaged 7 units of blood. And oof. I had to then become chief advocate. I didn't know what the hell I was doing. I ran around. We had her doctors, three black women who we chose particularly for this reason, although we didn't want this reason to ever be there. They came back, put her in a crash cart. Anyway, they had emergency surgery, and she was in ICU the first 36 hours of my kid's life. And he's like, what does that have to do with justice? And it has to do with the fact that African-American female mortality is a huge issue, because black women are 4 times more likely to die during childbirth than their white counterparts, all because of the implicit biases we have in our healthcare delivery system and their voices not truly being heard. And then the last thing is 2 months later, my little baby girl who's running around here somewhere, Sadie, she got diagnosed with biliary atresia, which is a very rare liver disorder. And she was placed on the transplant list. And for 93 days, she was on the liver transplant list. And, you know, it's 93 days of each day watching your child die before your eyes. She was really skinny, had this big belly, and was yellow. But she had this amazing smile every day. Like she was just so, so pleasant. And on September 1st, we got a chance to get the gift of life. But I've been on the inside and seen how broken our transplant system is. And I've seen that you have to have some means in order to actually flourish and thrive. And so from access to care growing up in Denmark, from African-American female mortality and a very nuanced and specific issue of a broken transplant system, I've seen how social justice plays out in our healthcare system, Charlie.
You had a debate, if I remember correctly, with the Surgeon General about the question of, of whether or not some of these disparities might be the result of lifestyle choices. Am I remembering this correctly? That does tell me about that.
Yes. So I was really disappointed, and I want on another note, I want a psychologist or sociologist or somebody to write a book on the men and women around Donald Trump and how they lose every sense of their being and how they become a shell of themselves. It's really unbelievable to watch people lose their strength and their fortitude around him. And my point to General Adams was that he was the only Black person in the room. And to get up there and say, you know, Black folks should stop drinking and smoking and like do it for your abuela and do it for your mima and papa, whatever, I thought was intellectually dishonest and beneath the office, because he did not outline those systemic injustices that I talked about. And you're like, okay, let's rewind a little bit. If you live in a food desert, if you live in a food desert, you're more likely to get, you know, cheaper alternatives, more sugar alternatives. So you're likely to have diabetes. You're drinking unclean water, breathing unhealthy air. You're more likely to have different cancers and different asthmas. You don't have access to quality care, so you're not getting preventive medicine. So these things perpetuate. That leads to your comorbidities, and that leads to your preventable illnesses. And when you overlay a pandemic, that's why more Black people are dying. It ain't because we drink more or smoke more, because that's not the case. It's because of these underlying ills. And so I didn't want him standing up there on the podium, having the world watch, and that's what he told us to do. I just thought it was beneath the office.
So I had a conversation with a colleague in my previous life who was the editor of the largest African American newspaper in Wisconsin. And just to give you a little bit of background, he had some significant health problems. One day after we were doing the TV show, I said to him, I said, Michael, are you okay? Because you look like shit. And he said, yeah, I'm okay. So I called his wife and I said, I'm sorry, something with Michael. I don't know what it is. And in fact, they rushed him to the hospital and, he was there for about 6 months. He was very, 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 very ill. But I remember having this discussion with him about sort of, you know, the difference between environment and lifestyle and various choices. And he had suffered from high blood pressure his whole life. And, you know, and it was making the case that you were making. And I, you know, at some point asked him, well, you know, why? He says, everyone I know has high blood pressure. I said, well, why is that? And I was thinking, is it diet? Is it drinking? What is it? He says, because we're angry all the time.
Yeah.
You've talked about this, and you talk about this in the book, the sort of underlying anxiety that I'm not sure that people like me always see or understand. So talk to me about that a little bit.
Yeah, I mean, it manifests itself in different ways. For me and my family, it's, you know, I look at my father every day and I know what he's been through. I mean, and you can still see the little wound in his shoulder. You know, the state of South Carolina, he's the only person to be blamed for the deaths of three others, including a friend of his. None of them were over the age of 19. We all know it's injustice. Everybody calls it injustice, but the state still calls it something else. So you see his eyes don't pop like they used to from shedding so many tears, and his shoulders aren't as upright as they once were from carrying the burdens of a generation. So you see the toll that takes. You see the trauma and the pain associated, the range of emotions. Just yesterday, we have a funeral of another Black boy whose life was cut short. You see the images of his daughter. And then you go down to Georgia in the case of Ahmaud Arbery, and you hear that the last words he heard while someone was standing over him was fucking nigger. Mm-hmm. It's the rage. I mean, yesterday I went from going to a homegoing celebration, you know, in my heart and head for George Floyd, to just being enraged again. And you stay in this perpetual state. And, you know, their conversations, my daughter, I have a 15-year-old daughter as well as twins. And the amount of anxiety in your chest, because now I have to have a conversation with her that you don't necessarily have to have with your kids. You know, I don't want her to be Sandra Bland. You know, I don't know. You know, I have been talking to her a lot about when, you know, she's out with her girlfriends, because I let them ride their bikes down to the little outdoor park. And there's this propensity for some white folk not to mind their damn business and come up and harass Black folk and while they're birding or eating barbecue or doing something like that. And so we have conversations about how to be respectful and how to be polite and how to navigate those situations. And what happens if law enforcement comes? And, you know, when you're driving, never, ever pull over on the side of the road if it's dark. Always call 911 and go into a well-lit area. You know, ask for his badge number if you can politely, but don't raise your voice and show it, show your hands. And, you know, it's just, it's this different way of living the American dream. And it's one that comes with the burden, but it's a very real, real reality.
So we're having an interesting conversation here. And that, and there's this, there's a cliche in the world, which you've heard of before. We need to have a dialogue about race. We need to have a conversation about race. And I mentioned this to a friend of mine, and we were talking about the need to have a conversation about race. And this person said that, well, the reason that we don't have these conversations about race is because they always boil down to, and you say, from the African-American point of view, I'm a victim, you're a racist. You need to, the only acceptable dialogue is for the white person to confess guilt and ask for forgiveness. And after a while, people just don't want to have that conversation. So I thought that was unfair. But that's the way it plays. And I think it's one of the, going back to our discussion is, are we going to make any progress? I do think that there's a fear on the part of a lot of white Americans that they don't really want to we don't really want to have a dialogue, that we want to have basically, you know, you are innocent, you are guilty, and people are not willing to do that. Do you follow where I'm going in there?
I follow that. And I think that we have to have, I think race is more than a blunt force object. And I think it's more nuanced than that. And I think our conversations have to, I mean, our conversations have to be like the one that you and I are having. I mean, it's about history. It's about the way you frame things. It's about the way that you look at things. Like, now you know that much more about me. So it's easier for you to empathize with me, right?
Yes.
And you know where I'm coming from. And so that's what I'm, you know, I wrote a whole book so that, you know, I'd say that Black folk can have a sense of pride and white folk can get some understanding, because we have to have one of the things we're missing in this country is empathy. We can't imagine putting ourselves in other people's shoes. And when this American experiment doesn't work if you don't have empathy. It just doesn't, because you have to have understanding and empathy for others' plight, others' struggle. And that is the only way that this thing works. And so I want people to have these conversations. They're very, very difficult. And I also want people to know that you can only really be two things right now. The moment demands that you either be racist or anti-racist. It's not enough to say, it's not enough to just say, I'm not racist, but like, you have to be actively willing to root that out in your own conversations. Part of these discussions, though, Charlie, aren't between. And this is, I think this is the point that a lot of Black folk make that goes missing sometimes. A lot of these discussions that are necessary aren't between, you know, Bakari Sellers and Charlie Sykes. The conversations that are necessary between Charlie Sykes and some of his white friends, because you are more open-minded and empathetic than some others may be, but Bakari Sellers may not be the right messenger. You might be the right messenger.
You know, I want to go back to this point about empathy that you're making, because I think it's very powerful. I don't know if you follow me on Twitter, but a couple of days ago, almost offhandedly, I retweeted a video of I would say about a 40-year-old Black man who's just speaking into the camera. And I said, I'm sure there's more powerful things on Twitter, but I haven't seen it. And what he is it's like, I don't know if you've seen this video where he's describing who he is, you know, the way his mother was, you know, how he was raised, very personal, you know, what he thought about goat yoga, what foods he ate, what music he listened to, what teams he
was for. The Now This video.
Yes, the Now This video. And it gets to the end, said, I just wanted you to know me before you call the police. And I put that up, and I've had more than 8.5 million impressions on that. And I think it's because that's what cuts through. You know, it's that, you know, when you look at me, think of me as this complicated human being who's got the strengths and the weaknesses and the difficult relatives and all of these other things before you call the police. That was one of those moments where I thought maybe this is a moment because it just touched a nerve. It was human. Now, some people pushed back and said, you know, this shouldn't be necessary. We should not have to proclaim our humanity, which, of course, is absolutely true. But I did think that it was one of those moments where people went, okay, you know, I am willing to listen to this and to think about this. So that was the one little glimmer of maybe there is going to be a shift. We are going to have that kind of a conversation.
I think so. And I actually agree with you. And I think that that video is extremely powerful. And thank you for reposting it to your audience and your platform. But that's the type of conversation that has to be had where we no longer see people as a threat because of the color of their skin. We give them the benefit of their humanity. And you never know, relationships can be formed, as you know, with friends along the way, you know, out of the weirdest places, Bakari Sellers and Nikki Haley, Bakari Sellers and Mick Mulvaney, because you get to know people and you have a certain level of empathy. And I think it's necessary. It also is quite evident that one of the reasons that we're on this track is because, regardless of what people say, leadership matters. And when your leadership is devoid of empathy, it usually passes down.
Yeah, this is the whole question of do appeal to the better angels of the nature of our nature, because you know that there are people who have, and I think of it maybe erroneously as a latent gene. It's a latent, there's a latency, certain attitudes, certain emotions that, you know, will be allowed, you know, will fester and may burst into flame if they're encouraged by the wrong voices. On the other hand, there is always that person, whether it's a minister, a pastor, you know, somebody in the military, a teacher, who's going to put their hands on your shoulder and say, you know what, that's not acceptable. You can't say those things. You know, you're wrong to have those kinds of stereotypes. And so you can have the same person go in completely different directions compared to the leadership, depending on the leadership they get educationally through the churches, through the political world. And I get the sense right now that we have some, you know, rather than appealing to the better angels of our nature, we have people pushed in the different direction. Can I, by the way, give you an example of this?
Please do.
Okay. So I was debating whether or not to do this. You know, I don't know whether Laura Ingraham actually listens to herself. I mean, seriously, you know, but millions of people watch this and nod their heads, but videotape exists. This is Laura Ingraham basically saying that black athletes who spoke out about police violence need to shut up and dribble, you know, immediately followed by her passionate defense of a white football player who had also made controversial comments. And the contrast is, I think, to put it mildly, striking. I just want to play this.
It's always unwise to seek political advice from someone who gets paid $100 million a year to bounce a ball. Oh, and LeBron and Kevin, you're great players, but no one voted for you. Millions elected Trump to be their coach. So keep the political commentary to yourself, or as someone once said, shut up and dribble.
Well, he's allowed to have his view about what kneeling and the flag means to him. I mean, he's a person. He has some worth, I would imagine. I mean, this is beyond football, though. This is totalitarian conduct. This is Stalinist. And by the way, on the streets of New Orleans, we're looking at live pictures. They're shouting, F Drew Brees. Wow. That's what this moment has done to the beautiful team spirit of the New Orleans
Saints. He's a great Christian man. He's,
you notice they didn't say, shut up and throw the ball, Drew.
And, you know, I was thinking, I can't put my finger on it. What's the difference between Drew Brees and LeBron James?
And by the way, I don't know about you, but I don't know that America voted to have Donald Trump as our coach.
Definitely not. We would be pushing 0-16 right now to keep the football metaphor going.
You know, it is interesting. There is a moment that I am noticing, even among conservative, you know, the anti-Trump conservatives, you know, who are, you know, anti-Trump, is they don't defend Trump. They just attack anybody that attacks him, beginning to rethink the reaction to kneeling. It's very interesting listening to people like Mike Pence say that, well, we're all in favor of, you know, people exercising their First Amendment right to peacefully protest. But he was the guy that stormed out of an NFL game to protest football players who were taking a knee. And I think in retrospect, the reaction to that, that didn't age well. Because, I mean, even though the right decided
that you sense some hypocrisy here. Is that what that is?
It runs deep.
It runs deep. I tell people often, they like, analyze this moment. Why are we here? Why are people in the streets? I'm like, well, we tried to kneel and you called us sons of bitches. So you didn't listen then. I mean, so now people are protesting. I mean, so now you have to listen. And we're absent that leadership from on high. I don't know if you've seen The Rock's video. It's pretty long. But The Rock has this very somber, where is our leader moment in this, really, because The Rock is very muscular and he always wears really small shirt.
You talk about Dwayne Johnson for people.
Johnson. Yeah. And so, you know, people are asking that question. I think even Republicans are asking, and I just don't think he has the necessary traits to meet this moment.
Well, when I saw that video, one of the things I thought is that has the potential of damaging Donald Trump's brand, because, you know, part of that brand is I'm the manliest man, which, of course, is absurd. But when you have Dwayne Johnson there, he basically says, you know, you're not the only one who can play the masculine card here. Bakari Sellers, thank you so much for spending so much time with us. The book is My Vanishing Country, and the Kirkus Review describes it as a strong voice for social justice emerging in an engaging memoir. So it is it's highly recommended reading. And we really appreciate, Bakari, you spending so much time with me on the Bulwark Podcast.
Thank you so much. Everybody go out to Amazon or your local bookstores, whatever, click it, order it, and share it with a friend, especially for Father's Day. Charlie, thank you. And shout out to our friend Tim Miller for putting us together. This is an honor to be with you, brother.
You must be an empathetic man to be friends with Tim Miller. That's all I can say.
Listen, I'm trying to get to heaven somehow.
And thank you all for listening to today's Bulwark Podcast. We'll be back on Monday, and we will do this all over again.